All right. Well, everyone, welcome. This is the A16Z crypto research chat. Wait, I have to make Joe a speaker. I'd like to speak.
Yeah, Joe's still just a listener.
Yeah, sure. He's got to accept it. Anyways. All right. Sorry about the technical difficulties. A lot of people's first time on using this. There we go. Awesome. So we have some great people here. We have Sonal and Mike and Ali from, so Sonal and Mike from our cons and content team. Ali is a general partner with me at the firm. Tim Roughgarden, who we announced yesterday, is leading our research team. Joe Bonneau, who's also one of the founding members of our research team. And I think we might have a few more folks joining. Not sure, but we'll add them on as they come. So I guess I'll just kick it off with, I think the agenda is we want to get into some like fun technical topics and not make this too kind of much about, you know, us and kind of our announcement yesterday, but we do want to kind of just give a little bit about that. So I'll start kick it off with Ali and Tim, maybe, who can talk about what we announced yesterday and what we're building.
Yeah, that sounds great. I'll keep it short. So the short of it is that we're building an industrial research lab the likes of DeepMind or OpenAI, which were a big inspiration for all of the work that we've done, but for crypto. And this has been a conversation that we've been having for about 18 months. And we've been talking to people like Tim, like Dan Bonet, also a lot of our founders in the portfolio, to really try to hone in on what exactly we should build and how it should work. And we have one observation, which is that whenever there is a key technological breakthrough that can lead to all sorts of different kinds of applications, like the kinds of breakthroughs that are very general purpose, and AI here, by the way, is a good example, there is an opportunity to create a research lab, an industrial research lab that bridges the world of scientific research, namely academia, with industry practice. And we consider DeepMind and OpenAI, they're both very successful examples of this kind of research lab. And another observation was that it is now very clear that Web3 and crypto are very much a domain that is a new area of study and that has that same property. It's a general kind of breakthrough that emerged when blockchains emerged at the very beginning and has led to all sorts of interesting new kinds of applications. It's very clear that the design space is incredibly rich. And so we saw a similar opportunity to create an industrial research lab to again, bridge the world of scientific research with practice. And we want to do that in a unique way, which is to do that with our portfolio. The hypothesis here being that the best kind of research will happen by connecting the smartest scientists, the smartest researchers in the world with the most interesting problems that people are working on, namely the problems that we see, you know, people in our portfolio and also in the broader Web3 and crypto community, such that interesting things can happen. Like we think that'll lead to the magic. And our intent is for this to cover the entire pipeline from research idea to production code / products, protocols that are running out in the real world. And so to that end, the research team here will be collaborating closely with our engineering team under Eddie Lazarin, as well as our regulatory and policy team under Miles Jennings and Michelle Corver, and also with our marketing team to be able to tell a story about and to be able to educate the broader community about the work that we're doing, all in close collaboration with our portfolio. So that's kind of the high level vision. I'll turn it over to Tim, who can chime in, and then we would like to make sure that we give each of the members of the team an opportunity to introduce themselves and talk a little bit about their background and the work that they've done.
Great, thanks, Ali. So maybe just to add in a little bit from sort of the researcher side. There are areas of computer science which are sort of mature enough where, you know, you can kind of just, you know, read the latest papers from researchers and sort of know what the most important problems are to go next. But the science and technology of Web3 is nowhere near that mature yet. And so it's really, you know, if all you do as a researcher is kind of look at the sort of academically published papers out there, you're not necessarily going to know what are the most important research problems to work on over the next few years. And so that's why, you know, I think it's been, certainly it was one of the big reasons I jumped at the opportunity to really sort of be in the thick of things at A16Z. And I think all the researchers we've been talking to really get this as well, that the sort of, you know, the sort of unique bird's eye view you get of everything that's happening in the space By being at A16Z, you really learn about, you know, what are going to be the most important research questions, I think, years earlier than one would otherwise. You know, and as Ali said, I mean, we really firmly believe that this is sort of a new discipline kind of forming, you know, before our eyes in real time. And so the opportunities to do fundamental research are just huge. I mean, there's really, I expect, you know, research done in the next year or two to already be taught in undergrad classes, you know, by the end of this decade.
Yeah, just to add to that, the reason, like, at least for me, I always think about DeepMind and OpenAI and these kind of modern AI labs as kind of aspirational goals. What I find so inspiring about those organizations is, I think of it as kind of like at least three things. Like, one, they have, you know, very legitimate and respected academic research. They put out papers, and, you know, they do it, I think, my understanding is they do it in almost a completely open source way, which is definitely how we want to operate, and just kind of advancing the field. But two, they also then do, you know, kind of applied things. They build software and do kind of neat stuff like that. And then, but then the third leg of it, they do a lot of, you know, documentaries, you know, they AlphaGo stuff, things like this. I think this, like, our view is this is important because, to Tim's point, like, it's striking in academia how skeptical a lot of computer scientists are of this field. And I think we have a lot of work to do to kind of turn that. I'm sure we will turn it, as Tim just said. But I think one important lever for doing that is really, you know, kind of high profile use cases that are, you know, that have utility, societal value, et cetera, and they get a lot of attention. So we kind of think of it, and I think those AI organizations really did that and really kind of captured people's imaginations. And so I think it's a really great model to aspire to. Maybe with that, we could jump in a little bit to kind of some, move beyond the A16Z stuff and kind of get into some fun technical topics. Maybe Tim, starting with you, maybe if you could tell us a little bit about your background, particularly, you know, the field. For those who don't know, he's one of the pioneers of a field called algorithmic game theory, which is, I think, a really cool area that kind of combines, you know, kind of the scale of the internet with older ideas in game theory. Maybe Tim, if you could talk a little about that, and then we'll move on after that to your interest in blockchains.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, so I did my PhD, it was like 99 to 2002. And at that time, you know, the internet was really just starting to explode at that point. It was really starting to become commercialized and widely used. So it was a really exciting time to be a computer science graduate student because computer science was really changing in a big way. It was obvious to sort of, you know, everyone across the discipline that computer science needed to be different, you know, because of the sort of explosion of the internet. And one of the things that happened around that time is computer scientists realized that they really needed to understand economics and game theory to reason accurately about the new computer science problems that were coming out at that time. And that had, there had not been much interaction between computer science and economics prior to then. So I was lucky enough to get sort of in on the ground floor of that movement. And, you know, my whole career, my calling card has sort of been the connections and interplay between computer science and economics. So for my PhD, you know, I was working on problems closely related to the internet. For example, you know, understanding the consequences of selfish routing between different internet service providers. When I was an assistant professor at Stanford, I got really into a field of microeconomics known as mechanism design, which kind of broadly is sort of, you know, making good decisions when you don't know in advance exactly what people want, what people's preferences are. One of the main application areas of mechanism design is the design of auctions. And so sort of in the aughts, auctions were becoming very prominent in computer science through, you know, business models of sort of, you know, the big Web 2 companies for real-time, you know, auctions for advertising. And then also there's really nice connections in sort of, you know, at a totally different, you know, so advertising auctions are sort of, you know, a billion auctions run in a day for a dollar each. There are also applications where it's one auction for $1 billion. Like, for example, the auctions that governments run to sort of sell wireless spectrum licenses. And that's another really nice sort of fertile ground for the interplay between computer science and economics. So with all of that backdrop, right? So naturally, when, you know, blockchain and cryptocurrencies came along, it's kind of like, how could I not work on this, right? I mean, I've never seen a technology where the economics are sort of so deeply embedded in the technology itself. You know, so Bitcoin I found very striking when it first came out. It wasn't obvious to me like what would be the most important research question to do at that point, but I certainly followed the space from a distance throughout most of last decade. You know, and I would say it was probably, you know, in general, the way I learn things is by teaching courses on it. So it's very frightening when you first teach it because you don't feel like you really know what you're talking about, but you do learn an enormous amount. And so I started, you know, teaching courses on blockchains, you know, just really as a forcing function to get me to learn it sort of more deeply. And in doing that, by something like 2019 or something, I was completely sold on the vision, you know, of what I like to call kind of, you know, a big computer that lives in the sky and sort of runs as a public good. So sort of the vision of general smart contract platforms. And as far as kind of the research I've been doing in this space, I mean, I think what's cool is there's super interesting open questions all up and down the quote unquote stack, both from sort of very kind of like low level implementation stuff to kind of the application layer. So I've been trying to kind of work on different parts of the stack. You know, I've been working some on just consensus problems. So really developing a theory of permissionless consensus to mirror the classical theory of the 1980s around that was developed for permissioned consensus. And then also thinking some about mechanism design style problems at the application layer, right? So for example, in auction theory, there's a very rich theory of optimal auction theory developed by Roger Meyerson. He won a Nobel Prize for that. And it would be, you know, I really, you know, I think one can aspire toward having an analogous theory around, you know, some of the applications that you see, for example, in the DeFi space. So like an optimal theory of automated market makers would be sort of one holy grail to go for. And I guess the other thing I should mention, I mean, another thing that was significant in my own kind of just involvement in the space was in 2020, the Ethereum community reached out to me because they were, Vitalik had proposed this transaction fee mechanism, EIP 1559. And, you know, some members of the community thought it was a really good idea. And they asked me to take a close look at it. And I came to the conclusion that indeed it is a really good idea. I spent several months analyzing it and writing a long report about it. And so at that point, not only was I all in on the space, but I think it was obvious to everybody that I was all in the space, having taken the time to write that 58-page report on that transaction fee mechanism.
All right, awesome. Thanks, Tim. Maybe let's go to Joe next, Joe Bonneau. Joe, maybe if you could tell us a little bit about your background. I thought your your PhD thesis and then kind of how you got crypto pilled. And Joe's one of Joe's many claim to fame is he originally was the crypto pilled our own Dan Benet, which is a pretty epic background. So, anyways, Joe, maybe we could start with your prior pre blockchain experience, the passwords and things.
Yeah, sure. So I started my PhD in 2008. So the Bitcoin white paper came out like my first or second year as a PhD student. The main focus of my PhD was on authentication protocols for the web. So I looked at passwords a lot and also a couple other things. And it was, at the time, it was pretty exciting because we had big data sets on passwords for the first time. So all this, there'd been kind of 20 years of speculation about how secure passwords were or weren't. And everybody kind of had an idea that they weren't great, but you know, there weren't really any numbers attached to that. And all of a sudden we had data sets with tens of millions of passwords and you could really do fine grained statistics and look at, not just how strong passwords are, but, you know, in a whole bunch of different contexts for different types of users, for different types of applications. So I had the main thrust during my PhD was analyzing all that data, figuring out how to collect it in a privacy preserving way, kind of tying it to the field of crypto. But I had this side interest in blockchains the whole time. I think sometimes I look back and think I should have just gone for it and written, you know, what would have been like the first PhD thesis ever about blockchains. But it was like, I guess, just slightly too new at the time. But the story I tell sometimes is when I think my second or third year, we had a Friday research group meeting every week. And a lot of the time we'd have speakers or somebody would be assigned to present something. So we had something to talk about. And one week somebody canceled and my supervisor on like Thursday afternoon at the end of the day said, maybe you can, you know, we need something for tomorrow. Can you talk about this Bitcoin paper that first came out? And I never heard of it. So I was like, oh, okay, sure. It's the paper's only 10 pages long. And I was like, yeah, I can read this by tomorrow and present it for the group. And it ended up turning into this late night affair trying to figure out, right, the Bitcoin paper is pretty easy to read, but it leaves a lot of detail out. So I was up reading the code and reading some of the early forum posts trying to figure out how things actually worked in practice. So I felt like I could explain it to this group of people. And yeah, that was, you know, basically it. I was like hooked pretty much right away that this is really something different. So after I finished my PhD, I did two postdocs, one at Princeton, which was great because it led to this textbook that that I co-wrote with a group of people at Princeton. The kind of like Tim said, I mean, teaching is really when you learn. So, you know, trying to write that textbook really required digging way deep into a lot of stuff that was really not documented at the time. It ended up being a great experience, not just from learning, but I realized that a lot of professors were reading the textbook, which is a little unusual for a textbook, I guess. But a lot of people wrote and said, oh yeah, like I've been meaning to catch up on this blockchain thing for so long, but it was confusing. And then I, you know, just decided to try reading the textbook. And then I got really interested in the space. So hopefully, you know, the contribution of that textbook was convincing a lot of academics in like the mid 2010s that, you know, there was interesting stuff going on. And then, yeah, I did a postdoc at Stanford with Dan Bonet. And, that was like when Dan was first getting interested, and he was, you know, slightly skeptical, but I think he was receptive. And I was like, yeah, this, we can definitely find some stuff to do here, Dan, and we can find some real crypto problems. It ended up leading to the work on VDFs, which is probably in the blockchain space, the technical thing I'm most known for is starting the work on verifiable delay functions and, you know, looking at different applications to randomness protocols. And people have come up with other applications in the crypto space too. So I've worked on VDFs, and I've, you know, done a bunch of other kind of side blockchain projects in the meantime. And
can you, Joe, do you mind for people that don't know, talking about explaining what VDFs are?
Yeah, sure. So the VDFs, verifiable delay function, it's a crypto function where the main security property is that you can't compute it in less than a certain amount of time. So it's an inherently sequential function. It's not easy to, well, it's should be like, we don't know how to speed it up with parallelism. So the only way to speed it up is by having some processor with a really fast clock speed, which is expensive and hard to do. You can't just throw a lot of processors at the problem. And it turns out to be really useful in all sorts of different protocol designs. Things like the classic example is like, there's a lot of commit reveal protocols where everybody's supposed to commit to something, which could be a random input to a randomness protocol. It could be a bid in an auction. And then, you know, you have to have some mechanism to have people actually open their commitments and reveal. With VDFs, you just have a slow function that opens the commitment. So it's not possible, you know, you don't have to rely on people actively opening them. Like anybody can open them in a certain period of time. And the time delay kind of covers network latency and, you know, make sure that, you know, everybody, you know, people don't have to post it exactly the same time, but that's kind of okay because they don't have enough time to open everybody else's commitments or, you know, test out different random values they can post or whatever the security property is for the specific protocol. So, so we kind of identified this weird, for crypto, it's a bit weird, you know, that you design something to be slow. Usually, you know, we want everything in crypto to be fast. But so we identified there were a couple applications, and then kind of the way crypto research usually starts is you spec out an idealized functionality. Like if we had a function that had these three properties, then, you know, we could build some really, really cool stuff. And then, we proposed the first construction and said, yeah, you can actually build this thing. That kind of, you know, kicked the space off. And since then, a lot of other researchers have proposed different VDF constructions. And in the last, I guess, 3 or 4 years now, since the first paper came out, we've had like something like 100 papers on VDFs and whole workshops on it. And there's about 10 different subtypes of VDFs with extra additional properties. So it's been a really fun crypto space to see develop. And hopefully they'll be deployed more in practical protocols soon.
Great. Thank you. Scott, maybe we'll go to you next. If you could tell us a little bit about your background and that kind of how you, your kind of early academic career, and then we could jump into your interest in crypto.
Sure. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks.
So I'm Scott Commoners. I studied market design, you know, and it actually, one step back, I did a lot of work in number theory in college. So I am excited to be getting back into the world of, you know, that borders on number theory. But my economics, you know, research work has been on market design, which is the field that thinks about how you structure and design economic systems to make them run better. It's sort of a, you know, in the same way that economics is a way of looking at the world and thinking about sort of what the forces and incentives that drive different outcomes are, market design is sort of like the engineering lens on top of that. It asks, okay, how can we use economic theory and analysis in conjunction with a lot of technical tools, computer science and like market clearing algorithms, you know, applied math, like, and sometimes like a little bit of ethnography and sociology to like better understand the markets we're interacting with. How can we use all of these tools together with a fundamental understanding of the incentives to make the system work better? And my PhD work, you know, was very much about sort of fundamental research on the, you know, sort of structure and market clearing mechanisms for what are called matching markets, for settings where, you know, you have potentially very complex transactions where different individuals want to, you know, care about whom they're transacting with and how. And this feeds very naturally. And in my, you know, sort of job as a business school professor, right? Like I spend some time thinking about these fundamental theories and sort of market clearing mechanisms and auctions like Tim was talking about. But then I also spend a lot of time helping companies figure out how to use those ideas to better make their, you know, platforms or marketplaces work. You know, so when you're a two-sided marketplace platform for online education or something of the sort, and you have like these challenges around like, to what extent do you, you know, want to keep pushing the content from the creators that are already well established versus like bring in new creators and sort of give them a way to, you know, sort of to gain traction. You know, and there are often tensions, right? Your short run incentive is typically to push the, you know, the creator that's going to get the most views that you think are sort of like, you know is most successful. But the long run health of your platform depends on your ability to optimize for the long run, to bring in new creators, to constantly enable someone to be successful on your platform, both so you can keep refreshing content and so people have an incentive to participate. And so market design thinking is sort of about trying to understand how to balance these trade-offs and how micro details, like how you choose which, you know, creators to match with which consumers, drive those, you know, sort of drive those outcomes and, you know, those incentives that produce the outcomes you want as a platform. And this type of thinking, of course, is like very naturally, translates very naturally to crypto. Like most crypto projects have an intellectual question like that at the core, right? There's like some system of incentives that a protocol or a crypto-based platform is going to create. And you have a lot of advantages, right? You can set them down transparently. You know, you can commit to them by putting them in code that everyone can audit and interact with sort of and is guaranteed to function in a fixed state, but you still have to get the incentives right. And so what's drawn me into crypto is that so many of the businesses and public projects have at their core a fundamental intellectual challenge that is sort of exactly the type of challenge that we face in market design. I should say, I'll say a little bit about sort of like, you know, what we're working on now and so forth. But I should say also early on, you know, I was also aware of this stuff in sort of the, you know, late 2000s, early 2010s. But I was actually on record as a big skeptic because so many applications that people were pitching at that time, right? And like I was interacting with people. They would like, you know, entrepreneurs would like come to my office hours and say, hey, I've got this idea for a project. But like the projects weren't using the technology in ways that were sort of, that were fundamental, right? That like, there was a lot of, we're trying to take this thing and just now make it decentralized. But decentralization is costly and they weren't gaining a benefit to offset that cost. What's really transformed And what's made me so excited about the space now is that we're now seeing huge waves of applications where there really is huge, like large fundamental value to the technology. And again, the design and balance between, you know, degree of decentralization and like what things live on chain, what things live off, like shape economic ecosystems that matter. Oh, one other like sort of, sorry, go ahead, Chris.
Well, I'm just curious, are there like particular projects that kind of turned you that like first got you really? Yeah.
Well, sure. So the first project that like really got me that I got involved in, Christian Catalini invited me and also one of my former grad students, Ravi Jagadeesan, to work with him and many others on the design of the Diem protocol. And like the you know, there, right, the idea that you're going to have a fundamental transaction layer that sort of is backbone infrastructure for the world in the same way that, you know, the networks that manage the internet are backbone infrastructure for like all of information these days. Like, that's a case where the underlying technology is just like the only way to do it in some sense, right? Like, you know, if you're going to imagine a world where everyone can transact in a way that is, you know, with anybody else in a way that's sort of, you know, completely trustworthy, independent of like how you're interacting, you know, and who you are, it sort of has to be in a system that is, you know, heavily, you know, sort of heavily robust and like, you know, sort of many times replicated and also, you know, sort of baked into software in a way that people can understand and interpret and that's fixed and committed. And the other really cool thing about the idea of an infrastructure layer like that, of course, that lets you extrapolate from places that have really strong institutions to places that have weaker institutions, right? There's potential to sort of, you know, enable a stable medium of exchange in places that have weaker monetary policy because they can sort of lean on the institutions in the places that are doing the processing. So that was like the first thing I got really excited on. And it was the first time I really got to play with one of these intellectual challenges of the type I described, right? Like, if you're trying to imagine something that's going to work at scale as like a large infrastructure layer, but you have to bootstrap it and you have to bootstrap a network of validators, like how do you design for that, you know, full transition path in a way that is like, you know, sort of incentive compatible all the way along, that it doesn't sort of like break, that people want to enter and participate and it doesn't sort of break down or get subverted midway through. And then more recently, I've gotten very, very engaged in NFT communities and consumer crypto. And what's fascinating here, and again, this is an insight that Christian and Robbie and I wrote about briefly in a short paper. What's fascinating about NFTs to me is that unlike, you know, a currency is sort of only really useful as a medium of exchange once lots of people are willing to exchange goods and services for it, right? Like, and as a result, it takes a long time for a cryptocurrency to catch on because the vast majority of cryptocurrencies aren't ready to be used as mediums of exchange. And most people, even if they were, aren't ready to use them as mediums of exchange. And so like, you know, they can grow in value and they can be stores of value and sort of like used down the line. But you have to build like a really powerful infrastructure layer that everyone agrees is going to work and they coordinate on before like everyone can sort of gain the value from a given cryptocurrency. By contrast, NFTs are formed around like small communities. Right. The only people, you know, there are all these people saying like, I don't get it. Like, you know, does that token really mean like, you know, this is a piece of art, you know, like who cares, you know, like who cares that you have this digital token? Like I just copied the, you know, I right click save, right? I copied the art on my computer. The fact of the matter is it doesn't matter whether, you know, random people on the street think that a token means you do or do not own a given piece of art. All that really matters initially is whether the people who might want to own that piece of art agree that the token means ownership. And so this means that NFTs can sort of establish their value among a small community of holders and then grow outwards, which is a really powerful like consumer design paradigm.
So interesting talking about a consumer design paradigm because you're actually getting at more of the applications. I was actually thinking we should actually talk a little bit more about some of the cool applications and problems in the space that are really compelling to you guys because we wanted to do kind of a quick introduction with each of you, but we can use the rest of the time to talk about more of that. I don't know how, if you guys want to like maybe tackle some of the big challenges and opportunities you see there.
Sounds great to me.
Ali, do you want to kick it off? And then we can go again by folks. And by the way, we're missing two of our founding research team here. We don't have Benedict and we don't have Valeria who couldn't join last minute, but we'll definitely hear from them in a future space.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, we thought that maybe for the rest of the time, it'd be fun to go down the stack and talk about some of the open problems at each layer. And actually, I think, Scott, what you were just saying was super fascinating. And I think we should start at the top. We should start at the application layer. So we have this kind of understanding that a blockchain is this computer in the sky, as Tim put it, or as Chris likes to put it, it's a computer that can make commitments. And there's various applications that can be built on top of such a computer. And so there are many, many challenges at every layer. At the application layer, there are many challenges that have to do with incentives, that have to do with how to structure token economies. And Scott, I think at the risk of keeping you talking for too long, I would love to start with you because I think you've done a lot of work at the application layer, thinking about incentive structures around things like NFTs and around things like reputation systems. So I'd like to just give it back to you if you want to continue to talk a little bit about the work that you've done there And then we can all chime in, by the way, Tim, Joe, anyone else, feel free to jump in with either more ripping or other ideas, other interesting problems at each layer, and we can just sort of take it from there.
Awesome. And yeah, I'll try to be brief so it doesn't become a monologue. But yeah, so certainly one of the things I've been working with teams on the most and thinking about the most in my research is sort of like how you map the right sort of like how you optimize your token design, you know, for the use case you imagine in your ecosystem. And this could be as simple as if you have a utility token, there are challenges around money supply, right? If you print too many units of the utility token, then like suddenly the value crashes and maybe people don't want to collect it. But on the other hand, they are willing to spend it. And meanwhile, if your utility token is too scarce or people sort of foresee too much of the utility downstream, then maybe they all hoard it and no one spends it and you have no circulating money supply. And so it looks, you know, on the one hand, like, you know, sort of teams are saying, this is great, our token is worth so much. On the other hand, no one's actually using it in their ecosystem. And so like, you know, the overall like, you know, ecosystem can collapse. So there are simple like sort of macro balancing questions of that form. And then there are much more subtle ones. So like you alluded to this this piece on reputation tokens that I wrote with one of my former students, Jad Esper. And we talked to lots of different companies that are thinking about how do you use tokens to generate a durable system of reputation, right? And they're, you know, they're a creator platform and they want to reward people who've contributed content, or they, you know, sort of are, you know, a job search platform and they want to like reward people who are, you know, helping other people find jobs or something of the sort. And a lot of platform architects pick a token system where they are hoping their token is going to do two things. One is it's going to identify some people as having high reputation, like they're contributing a lot of value to the platform. But at the same time, they're hoping to like allow people to like, you know, liquefy like some of that value, right? Like be able to like, you know, internalize some of the benefits they're creating through some sort of like liquid token exchange, right? It's very natural, right? It's a way of rewarding your contributors to the platform. What Jad and I wrote about is, you know, there's a funny paradox, which is if you want to give people a reputation that's durable, but also want to make it liquid, and you only have one token, then, you know, suddenly now people can go and buy the token, it's liquid, which means it's a worse signal of reputation. Maybe somebody just bought a ton of it. And then, you know, suddenly now it's not a good signal of reputation, so it's also not worth any money, and the whole system collapses. So we like propose like a two-token model, and we talk some about how you balance these, like sort of like a durable reputation token that then spins off like a liquid token that you can use sort of as a medium of exchange. But so optimal tokenomics is one. Let me just point to one other application challenge, like layer challenge and big opportunity that comes with it, and then let's maybe move down the stack. A lot of the promise of Web3 comes from the idea that we're going to enable like people to use the interoperable layer that is the blockchain to sort of create sort of established, you know, assets like digital assets and forms of digital ownership that we can then point lots of different applications to and people can take with them from application to application, right? And that's like, that has a lot of promise in terms of competition policy, for example, right? Like consumers gain a lot more leverage if they can take the content they've created with them and move to another platform. But for all of this to work well, we really need, you know, sort of the transaction costs of the layers to be low and consumer technology around these, you know, the blockchain to be much, much more accessible, right? And so like, there's a ton of design at the, you know, at the consumer access level that we don't normally think of as part of the technical challenge, but it's very much part of the economic design challenge.
That's awesome. By the way, Ellie, before you move down the stack, I have to mention that coincidentally, Scott and Jad wrote that paper about the two-level token design that was edited by us before he was even thinking about joining our research lab, which is like crazy cool and coincidental.
Oh, right. I forgot to give the citation. It's in Future. I'll drop the link back at the top of my Twitter feed if people want it.
And we may or may have not started at that point to pitch Scott from potentially joining us. It's a long time coming. Anyway, yeah. Well, Scott, thing that you're saying is super fascinating. I think one of the things that I find so important about that is that one of the key problems in the space is that because we don't have a good mechanism for reputation, it's as if every interaction is forced to be a one-off prisoner dilemma style game, as opposed to a repeated or iterated prisoner dilemma style game. And so that kind of essentially forces you to assume that everyone you interact with in this space is an adversary, which very much constrains the kinds of mechanisms that you can design, because it's a very severe assumption that you have to make. So I feel like it's one of these like very fundamental problems that people in the space have thought a lot about. It's still, I think, like some of your ideas around having two tokens instead of one, making one non-transferable, making the other one transferable as a way of both capturing some of the reputational signal, but also being able to reward people with a fungible, are I think the right way to go. I know Tim also has thoughts along these lines. So we were actually talking with a portfolio company recently about a reputation system. And I'd just love to give Tim a chance here to chime in with any thoughts he might have, and then we can continue to move down the stack.
Sure. Maybe I'll riff a little bit on one or two things Scott said, and then we can move down a little bit. First of all, Scott, I'm really glad you brought up the kind of user facing design problem. I mean, that's clearly one of the biggest challenges facing the space, and because among the more sort of technical types, it doesn't get spoken about enough, I don't think. So I think it will happen. But one of the things that needs to happen to reach, one or two orders of magnitude more crypto users is exactly some advances in the user interface design part. And then the other thing, let me riff on is, because this is something actually I sort of don't really know where to put it in the stack as far as the layers. But like one place that it's obvious to me there are opportunities for incredibly important fundamental research is around stablecoin design. In particular, algorithmic stablecoins. There's lots of smart people that believe they're kind of fundamentally impossible, that any algorithmic stablecoin is sort of doomed to a death spiral and a collapse. And then there's other people that are betting like billions of dollars that they can be made to work. And this is the kind of topic that really it should be possible to have a really nice, rigorous theory. Presumably, the answer depends on your assumptions. So the question really is sort of, under what assumptions can you actually have kind of, keeping the peg with an algorithmic stablecoin? For example, you could imagine a theory having as output, guidance about exactly, how much and what type of backing of a stablecoin would be necessary and sufficient for stability under reasonable assumptions. So that's sort of riffing on, Scott bringing up DM. As far as going down the stack, so I should say you asked 10 crypto people, like, what are the layers of the stack? You're going to get a lot of different answers. So don't take what I'm saying too seriously. But one natural place to go next would be sort of the scalability problem. So layer two solutions. So the way I think of this, in back to the sort of analogy of the big computer that lives in the sky, we want two things, right? One, we want really cool applications deployed on that computer. That's sort of what we've been talking about over the last 10 minutes. But then we also want that infrastructure, if you will, right? So this virtual computer in the sky, we want it to be as powerful and robust as possible. And there's going to be a coevolution of these two things, right? So that the better the infrastructure, like the more transactions per second it can process, right? The bigger the sort of design space for applications. Similarly, once certain applications sort of catch fire, there'll be sort of extra, motivation and capital for sort of, improving the infrastructure. And we've seen this play out, over the internet for decades. So I definitely think there's, it's been one of the biggest areas of sort of intense work over the last couple of years, layer two solutions, including side chains, including rollups, really trying to sort of boost the, transaction throughput of a platform like Ethereum by, ideally at least two orders of magnitude and, hopefully eventually four orders of magnitude or more. And so here again, there's a lot of, I think, really nice competing designs. For example, in the rollup space, you've got kind of the game theoretic approach taken by optimistic rollups. You've got the sort of more kind of proof theoretic or cryptographic approach taken by ZK rollups, right? Just understanding better the pros and cons, the trade-offs between those two approaches, I think is really, there's opportunities for fundamental research. And certainly there is ongoing a lot of really amazing deep research about how to get ZK rollups like ZK snarks sort of as practical as possible. And for me, someone who's trained as a theoretical computer scientist, this is just like the most amazing thing to see because, these proof systems on which ZK snarks are based, they were introduced in the 1980s, really just by mathematicians, really just to study the mysteries of the computational universe, really just to understand what does it actually mean to prove something. And now fast forward, so one thing that's been amazing about the crypto space is all of these 20th century areas of computer science have just gotten, it's not like they ever went away, but they all just have these completely new lives at this point, through the new applications. And so snarks, which can be thought of as kind of a specific form of proof system, which now, billions of dollars is going into sort of heavily optimizing, You know, that's another great example of sort of the interplay between sort of fundamental research on the one hand, you know, and sort of very real problems. In fact, you know, technological challenges that are literally essential, you know, for Web3 to realize its full vision.
Tim, I think in the context of layer two, it may be interesting to just briefly touch on the data availability problem and also on the implications of proposals like EIP 4844 and how that might significantly improve the performance of layer two solutions today.
Sure. So, I mean, one thing, and you're right, Ali, this is a really nice sort of research question here. So let me kind of focus in specifically to Ethereum. And so, you know, as I'm sure many listeners know, in Ethereum, transactions cost gas. So basically, there is a single metric, okay, a single type of unit, which is called gas, and it's meant as a proxy for sort of all of the burden imposed by a transaction on the Ethereum network. And that burden is really multidimensional. Okay? So it includes things like, you know, computation. It includes storage. It includes bandwidth that the sort of nodes running, the full nodes running the protocol are using to sort of communicate with each other. So you have this really multidimensional cost of a transaction, but and yet that's sort of projected down into this one-dimensional space. You have to use this sort of one number gas to as a proxy for all of those burdens. So one of the key ideas in rollups is to solve the data availability problem. So what is the data availability problem? So basically you have this separate blockchain, this layer two, and it claims it sort of processed 1,000 transactions. It tried to help out layer one. It's like, hey, you know, layer one, let me take some of the burden off of your shoulders. Let me sort of process these 1,000 transactions, you know, and then kind of let you know what are the end results. Right. And that's fine. I mean, that's very nice. But then, you know, later on, how does anyone know actually what transactions were executed or whether they were executed correctly? And so data availability is kind of like, where do you find out the information of what actually happened? What were the transactions that were executed off chain? And so in the rollup solution, you know, that's stored as what's known as call data. So it's basically just published to L1. But sort of, you know, in a particular, using a particular type of relatively sort of cheap data. And anyway, so some of the proposals going on is like, well, you know, if having room for lots of call data is essential for kind of, you know, solving the scalability solution, right? So maybe we actually want to sort of think of things in a more multidimensional way. And so maybe sort of call data coming from rollups at layer one, we can sort of treat as cheaper. We can sort of increase the amount of capacity at layer one to handle the publication of call data while leaving the other parts unchanged. You know, rollups and call data is one particular instantiation of this, but just much more generally thinking multidimensionally about sort of the cost of transactions and pricing them accordingly, I think is a super exciting direction for research.
Joe, I wanted to give you a chance to weigh in here a little bit, if you'd like, on layer two tech and the challenges involved.
Well, less about the incentives for layer two, but at a high level, what I'd like to see, I've thought a lot about measuring decentralization in kind of more of like a, maybe not even quantitative, but at least like a systematic way. Because it's kind of interesting to me that doing transactions layer two with like ZK rollups, there's like a little bit of a trust placed in the rollup server. If you do, optimistic rollups, the trust model is slightly different. There's a whole lot of other, you know, layer two protocols that all sort of, I mean, the, you know, like payment channels, you know, is another one that has like a different set. There's like clearly a trade-off between you can get better performance at the cost of introducing some new parties into the mix that at the very least you rely on for reliability. You might also rely on them, you know, for some other properties too that you hope that they'll exhibit for the, you know, the rollout to work the way you want. But I feel like it's very, we don't have a really systematic understanding of like how much performance can you gain for what trade-offs in the trust model. And are these like actually fundamental limitations or is this just like the tech we know how to build now? So it's kind of like the high level, I think. Most academics have like the set of papers they'd like to write, you know, if they had a sudden like 3-month injection of free time. And that's been one for me for a while is kind of like a good mapping of that space.
That might actually be a good segue to thinking about how layer two solutions on top of Ethereum compare to just alternative layer ones. Curious what you guys think. either Joe or Tim or Scott, whomever, feel free to chime in.
And I'd just say quickly, it's a really similar, you know, there's a really similar high level question just between layer one, like what the real trade-offs are. Well, we're still at the point where people don't even really agree between the existing solutions, just between proof of stake and proof of work. We don't have a really good common understanding of what you're really sacrificing in the trust model by going from proof of work to proof of stake. I mean, and it's not even clear, I guess, it's a sacrifice in one direction or the other. Like they're each sort of have a different trust model and there's sort of some advantages to both of, you know, under what conditions the consensus protocol is going to behave correctly. And then, you know, in all sorts of different proof of stake and limitations, for example, it's like we don't really have a good way of saying like this one's slightly more robust at the cost of worse performance, or that one, you know, has better performance but is making like slightly stronger trust assumptions. So yeah, I mean, pretty much the same problem. Like even we don't know how to compare the existing solutions in a way that everybody agrees on. And part of that is because there's, you know, a lot of conflicts of interest and people want to say their solution's great and kind of overlook maybe the sacrifices they're making in trust model. And we certainly don't know what the theoretical limits are on, you know, like, do you have to sacrifice a little bit of, like, do you have to weaken the security model a little bit to get good performance? I feel like we definitely don't know the fundamentals of it.
Tim, can you add anything?
No, I the only thing I'd like to add is, you know, Jill, let's work on this. Let's work on that paper this summer.
Sounds good, yeah.
It may be fun to have a brief interlude about zero knowledge proofs specifically, because they feel like they are a very fundamental building block that is also very general. I feel like the implications of zero knowledge proofs being a thing may be as dramatic as the implications of smart contracts when they kind of emerged back when Ethereum was created. And I feel like we're only now starting to appreciate just how powerful zero knowledge proofs could be. And they also feel a little bit like magic. And so I wondered, maybe Joe, Tim, if you can unpack what a zero knowledge proof is at a high level, what it allows you to do, and what you think are some of the interesting applications or implications of them as a technology.
Joe's more the cryptographer, so I'll defer to him. But Joe, the one thing I might add to Ali that would be great to comment on is that the zero knowledge proof systems have been around for several decades. And I wonder your thoughts about, you know, I mentioned earlier about kind of these 20th century parts of computer science finding new life with blockchains and in crypto. And I wonder if similarly, somehow, you know, blockchains and their public nature may be, you know, really what makes zero knowledge proof systems go completely mainstream. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, yeah, I think that that's already almost uncontroversial that blockchains have been the thing that brought zero knowledge proofs, you know, mainstream. I mean, yeah, the idea has been around since the 80s and, you know, it was a Turing award winning idea. So pretty clear fundamental breakthrough that you can do a zero knowledge proof at all. So we've known for a long time that you can do it, and you can basically do a zero knowledge proof of anything. I mean, you can do a zero knowledge proof of any NP statement, which is, you know, almost anything interesting. That doesn't guarantee that there's actually an efficient zero knowledge proof protocol. So, you know, especially like a lot of the early constructions were sort of more proof of concept. It was like you could do a zero knowledge proof, but it might, you know, might take like 10,000 compute years to compute the thing.
For those who may not know, do you mind explaining what a zero knowledge proof is?
Yeah, sure. The core idea is just that you can prove that some mathematical statement is true, and that you actually know what's called a witness, or basically like a solution to some, you know, mathematical equation. And that it could be, it doesn't have to be a math equation, because you can express a lot of other things as a math equation. So the example that I give in class a lot is that you can prove that you know the solution to a Sudoku puzzle without actually revealing the solution. So the zero knowledge part is always that you're proving something's true, but not proving anything else. You're not revealing the solution or revealing what you know, but you're convincing the other party with overwhelming probability that you actually know it. So the application started with really simple things, relatively like proving that you know a discrete log of some group element or something like that. But you know, people have come up with generic proof systems where you really can kind of compile any NP statement down. And there's all sorts of natural applications in the blockchain space. You know, you can prove that a transaction is valid without actually proving or without actually revealing what the transaction is, like who's paying who or how much. So, you know, that's kind of the founding premise of Zcash and a lot of other privacy focused blockchains. And more generally, you can prove that the result of executing some really complicated smart contract is like these changes to the state, like this money moves from that party to the other. And maybe you don't even reveal the amounts because, you know, all the amounts are hidden. And, that means you can really potentially solve like the big privacy problem of blockchains, which is that you have to, you know, make all the data public so that everybody can verify it. If you're just verifying zero knowledge proofs of transactions rather than, you know, publishing the transactions and re-executing them, then it's obviously much better for privacy. So in the long run, we'd kind of like to get to a world where no interesting data is actually published on blockchains. It's just zero knowledge proofs of everything. So you can kind of get the benefits of public accountability and also have everything be private. Kind of a long road to get there technically, though. I mean, the current tools that we have just aren't ready performance-wise to have anything like the, you know, the kind of transaction throughput that we want for a practical system.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Tim, I've heard you actually give a pretty good breakdown of the properties of a zero knowledge proof, which may be helpful. Maybe even actually just starting with what the acronym even means in the case of a SNARK.
Sure. Yeah, no, happy to talk about that. So popping up a level, and this may sort of tie some of the different threads together a little bit, is I mentioned these proof systems, and there's really sort of two different aspects that are relevant for blockchains. One is the sort of succinctness aspect, and the other is the actual zero knowledge property. So Joe, so when I was speaking about sort of challenges at layer two and sort of optimistic versus sort of ZK rollups, there I was focused on sort of proofs that are succinct, by which I mean, you know, someone does a whole bunch of work and convinces you they did a whole bunch of work without forcing you to check their work, without forcing, you know, you don't have to redo their work from scratch. So that's what I mean by succinct. You can kind of save someone a lot of time. You do computation and then you just sort of convince them that you did it all. So that's not about privacy. Okay. So just that technology. And then zero knowledge is, you know, what Joe was talking about. That's really kind of a cryptographic aspect, which says that, you know, not only do you convince someone that you did something and that you know something, but you don't even actually leak what it is you know. You convince them that you know it, but you don't actually teach them what it is. So that's just the first thing. So ZK rollups is a bit of a misnomer. Often ZK rollups are used to describe proof systems that don't actually have zero knowledge. And so sometimes people prefer to call them validity proofs instead of ZK proofs for that reason. And so snarks, you can add ZK on top of a snark, but already just the basic sort of definition of a snark is pretty amazing. So as far as the acronym, So let me pop up a level. So in a proof system, like I said, originally it was meant to study the computational mysteries of the universe. Really, like, what does it mean to prove somebody to something? Something to somebody, excuse me. And so the kind of, formalism you use is that of two parties, sort of a prover who's relatively powerful and a verifier who is relatively computationally limited. This is actually an unbelievably good mapping onto kind of the layer one, layer two interactions in a blockchain, where the slow, low throughput layer one plays the role of the verifier, plays the role of the actor that has very limited computational power. And then the layer two would play the role as the prover. So that would be like a chain that maybe has higher trust assumptions, but also has higher throughput. And so, you know, the idea of a prover trying to convince a verifier something true, again, it maps on perfectly. Layer two wants to convince layer one that it did a bunch of transactions accurately. And so that's why these snarks are sort of, which came out of the proof systems literature, sort of the perfect fit for layer twos that proactively to layer one, you know, prove that they did what they said they would. Now, in this context, usually that just means like there's 1,000 transactions, they executed all of them, and they published sort of the new state route to layer one. That would be sort of the typical computation. Okay, so SNARK, so the S stands for succinct, So what that means is that it better not be the case that for layer one to check layer two's work, it has to literally redo all of layer two's work from scratch. That would totally defeat the purpose. You're trying to sort of take some of the load off of layer one's shoulders. And so the snark should be small, should not take up much space at layer one, and it should be cheap to verify, meaning you shouldn't need, for example, in Ethereum, you shouldn't need much layer one gas in order to verify, you know, that in fact, it is a correct proof. So that's the S, succinct. So basically just you can check work much faster than redoing it from scratch. The N stands for non-interactive. So in the original definition of proof systems in the 80s, the fable that was often told back at that time was like, imagine a sort of tutor and a student having a conversation and trying to mathematically define what would it mean. So the tutor here would be the more powerful sort of all-knowing prover. The sort of the person being tutored would be the verifier. And there's a definition of like, what kind of conversation is a convincing conversation? So you had these rounds of communication back and forth. So that was sort of the original notion of a proof system. But if you think about it, like you don't want like layer two and layer one to be talking back and forth like for a long time, right? You basically want, you want it so that anybody can sort of download, you know, these sort of software to run the Ethereum protocol, spin up a node and like, you know, immediately sort of verify everything that has happened up to this point. Even if it was a snark proof published by some L2 that was defunct as of 5 years ago. So you can't afford to have this interaction as far as the application and the in blockchains. So non-interactive just means, you know, one and done, right? So really the layer two just says here once and for all, publish to L1, you know, this is something anybody can verify now or in the future. And then the ARC, the AR stands for argument. So that just means there really should be a proof, meaning that the layer two can only generate a snark proof if in fact it's correct. In fact, it really did do those computations. And conversely, it should not be able to spoof sort of a correct proof. So if it didn't do the computations it claimed it did, then the verifier should not be tricked. The verifier should say, aha, I see the bug in your proof. I don't believe you that you did all of those transactions. And then so that's the AR, and then the K, which is the knowledge part. That's what Joe was talking about. That was like the witness. And so that again comes from zero knowledge considerations originally, but actually even in sort of validity rollups that are not zero knowledge, that's actually a really useful optimization for compressing the layer one footprint. So for example, normally to execute transactions, you need to make sure you have the appropriate signatures from the people initiating the transactions. And you can actually kind of sort of not publish those signatures to layer one in a validity rollup because they can serve the role of that witness. So in effect, layer two promises that it knew signatures generating that sort of authorized the 1,000 transactions that it executed along with sort of the final state after it did all of that execution. So that's kind of the guts of sort of what one of these snark proofs actually looks like. And that's the meaning of all the letters in the acronym.
I think that I could add to that. I mean, maybe this is getting more pedantic than people are interested in, but two things actually. You might see the term snark sometimes instead of snark. So there's a difference between a proof and a proof of knowledge. And like in the Sudoku case, I can prove to you just that this Sudoku puzzle has a solution, that it's not, you know, like a broken puzzle, versus proving that I actually know the solution. And turns out those are like mathematically, those are two different concepts. And so there are like what are called snargs, which are, you know, arguments that don't have this knowledge. You're just sort of proving something's true without proving that you know something, which is can be a little bit easier to construct. And a lot of the time, that's what people actually use. So I think we've kind of got to the point where people just say snark for everything, even if the K is not really there. But that's kind of like an optional property.
That is perfect. One thing I wanted to emphasize, which is something that you both said, but I think it's just so important. It's just like the concrete implication of this, at least one concrete implication of zero knowledge proofs for blockchains is that if you look at the way blockchains work today, every single node in the network essentially has to re-execute every transaction of every computation in order for the network as a whole to build confidence that the transactions were performed correctly. And one of the implications of a zero knowledge proof is that with this technology, you can have a single node run all of those transactions, run all of those computations, and then generate a proof, a zero knowledge proof, that those computations were done correctly. And then everyone else in the network just has to validate that proof. And that can be done much, much more efficiently than actually running the computation itself. That's a succinct property that Tim was referring to. And so that has massive implications to the way that blockchains get architected, to the potential performance and scalability improvements that we can see on blockchains in the future. It is also a key aspect of the implementation of rollups, like zero knowledge rollups that are based on this insight. So just wanted to emphasize that. We are certainly over time, but I wanted to maybe keep going for a little bit if people want to continue.
Yeah, just a little longer if you don't mind, Ali. Let's go till 7:30 and we can, or 4:30, depending on what coast you're on, and we can cut it off then.
Yeah, let's do it. And maybe we can finish with Scott. So Scott, I know you've done a lot of work on the creator economy. And there's like a lot of overlap between that whole body of work and crypto and Web3. And so I wanted to give you a chance. If you wanted to chime in on the kinds of things you've been working on or thinking about, maybe we can end on that.
Yeah. And also just one note is that it's another segue actually from what we were just talking about, because at the end of the day, everything that's happening at every layer is about enabling people to use this for applications that make sense. And so to me, the creator economy is really about like letting more people into doing more with Web3. And Scott, like you are the perfect person to just talk more about that and really what you're thinking and what you've seen as trends in that and what you think the interesting research problems there are.
Awesome. And indeed, it's very much ties in with these questions about the layers and the different types of transactions, because a lot of it comes down to access and infrastructure, right? So first of all, just, you know, to go back to NFTs, which you talked about earlier, just as a conceptual example, like what are they doing? They're enabling types of transactions that have been either non-existent or just very difficult to do in the past, right? So if you create a digital good, you know, pre-modern crypto infrastructure, there was no way to like define the owner of that good, absent a centralized intermediary that was actually like just defining ownership, right? So we had ledgers of digital goods in computer games and like other sort of like, you know, closed economic ecosystems. But if you were a creator who created whose creative form was digital, whether it was digital art or digital music, or certain forms of writing and things, you didn't have a way to sell the digital asset because there was no way to define the owner, right? And so one fundamental use case for NFTs is a sort of digital deed. And because they exist in the blockchain in a way that is, you know, sort of transparent and verifiable, and builds on all of this like sort of interoperable transaction architecture, so one can create an NFT or can create a series of them around like whatever your creative activity is. Now suddenly you can sell those things, right? That we can have a digital goods economy. You can be selling those assets yourself, and you don't need an intermediary like a label in the case of music or a gallery necessarily in the case of art, right? You don't need sort of an intermediary to certify you and your assets and that you sold them. Rather, you can just sell them, right? You can declare here is the token, and people can like buy and sell it. And if you can build a community of enthusiasts around your work, just like I was talking about before, you can like spin up, you know, sort of a broader ecosystem of enthusiasts. And as the people, you know, sort of become, you know, as those people like grow in number, then the early adopters, right? Your early enthusiasts, your first fans actually share some of that upside because, you know, whatever it is that, you know, the early assets they bought from you become more valuable. And so we're seeing this like, you know, emergent, creator economy built on digital goods. And so that's one really powerful opportunity. But of course, there's all sorts of, you know, we've pushed trust to a different level, right? So now you don't have to trust the asset, right? You know what the token is, but you have to trust now the mapping between that asset and like everything it means in the outside of the world, right? You probably, everyone in this call has experienced or at least watched a friend experience a rug pull or something of the sort where the asset, you know, the digital asset, you know, behaved as expected, but its relationship to the things that were off chain, you know, sort of very quickly fell apart. And so, you know, and similarly, you know, talking about consumer protection, right? How do people like curate and keep safe their digital assets while engaging in this marketplace? All of these are contexts where there are incentive design challenges wrapped in technical challenges, right? Like what can we do to give people the ability to interact their digital assets with a variety of different online applications without putting them at risk, right? Right now, you don't know what you're signing, you know, but, you know, and so you don't know what you can interact with necessarily. Can we do that? Can we like create technology that wraps your assets in a way that keeps them safer and you can sort of like do more of these outside interactions with less concern? And then on the creator side, right? this enables creators to enter more easily. And also it enables them to be, you know, sort of platform independent, right? If you can like create, you know, think about like a YouTuber today is tethered to YouTube, right? It's very difficult to take all of these videos you've designed for YouTube and their environment and all the reputation you've built up in their algorithm system and take it with you to something else, right? If you decided suddenly you wanted to like transition from YouTube to TikTok, maybe you could export your content, you could like reformat it and so forth, but you can't bring that reputation with you. Web3, at least in principle, lets you do that, right? Like all of these assets belong to you and the reputation that builds up around them. You can just like, you control it and you just point different applications to it.
It's fantastic, Scott. One last question. We're going to just quickly wrap up. And just a quick note that Tim had to drop off to head to some family event. But Scott, one last question. At the very beginning, you mentioned how you were very skeptical and then you eventually kind of, you know, came over to the side. What would one word of advice or thinking be for the room, you know, before people take off, like if they are trying to convince others to like take the space more seriously or get involved or they're crypto curious? Like, what do you tell your students and the people you work with? Like, what's your thing?
Oh, that is a great question. Indeed, I've this semester been teaching, you know, sort of a lot of our first ever HBS course materials on this stuff. I wrote the first case on NFTs or the Bored Ape Yacht Club case. I wrote one on the Looks Rare vampire attack. So I've been like grappling with this semester as my students are puzzling through this. And it's been really fascinating, by the way, watching them like argue out, like, what does digital land even mean? Because most of them come from far outside the space. Anyhow, what I show to people when I'm trying to explain to them what makes crypto powerful to me is all the ways in which crypto is either enabling new types of transactions that we always wanted to do but didn't have a technology to do, or enabling us to do existing types of transactions in more efficient ways, right? So like this idea that if you want to sell a digital artwork or like some other digital good, like we don't have a digital deed that represents the owner, or we didn't used to, but now we do. And you can imagine like all sorts of inefficiencies around like the way we've been like serving music over the internet. Like all of this, like at some fundamental level comes down to, if you want to have markets in something, you have to have property rights. And we didn't have property rights over these digital assets, but now we do, or at least we have a way to create them. You know, and so similarly, like this idea of like smart contracts as trusted code, right? Like lots of times we outsource trust to a centralized intermediary, but they take some rents, right? It's like, you know, ideally, it's funny, like, you know, Tim talked about going back in time into, you know, sort of classic computer science. We're also going back in time to classic economics, right? Like the earliest models of contracts assumed trust and assumed the contract was going to behave as planned. And so now we're living that again, or finally, rather.
That's fantastic. Well, on that note, since we said we'd wrap up, we just want to say thank you to everyone for joining. And for those that want to follow up, Scott posted that article he mentioned at the top of his feed. If you want to go to his account and you can find it there. At the top of Chris Dixon's feed, there's a Tweetstorm and Ali's feed. There's a link that you guys can follow if you want to follow our work, including subscribing to our newsletter and our upcoming podcast and more. And if you have any questions, just shoot us a note on Twitter. And thank you for joining us. Dixon, anyone, you guys want to add anything else?
No, it's awesome. We'll do any more of these.
Yeah,
thanks,
for sure.
Thanks everyone.
Yeah, thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks so much.
Bye, everyone. Thank you for joining, guys. Bye, everybody.